black and white and red all over, Ian Murta. He can talk football all day.
Back in the autumn, Newcastle put 8 past Sheffield United at Bramall Lane. That's 8. Now, what they're going to do to the Blades at St James's Park, which has become a fortress again? They can relegate Chris Wilder's side. I don't think it's going to be 8, but I think even Sunderland fans might think it's going to be a home win at St James's Park tomorrow. Chris, the Blades are possibly the worst side that the Premier League's ever seen. A lot of people have been saying that. And Chris Wilder came in for Paul Heckenbottom. He struggled to arrest the slump. And, well, they're certain to be playing Championship football next season when they'll be up against Wilder's former club, Middlesbrough. We all really knew that they weren't going to make the playoffs, didn't we? And that lead result, albeit a wonderful game at the Riverside on Monday night, settled the issue. Sunderland, well, all Sunderland have to play for is a top half finish, and really they need to get something tomorrow at Watford, who are 2 places and 3 points below them. But Sunderland are 3 points behind 12th place Bristol City, and it would be good if they're in the top half of the table. It's not a great honour. It's trivial in many respects, but it will look better in the history books, won't it?
Certainly will. And I mean, how much of this is going to be, particularly the Sunderland game, how much of this could be end of season? Nothing really counts on the game. So let's just see it out. Don't know what type of game we're going to get.
Well, that's right. I mean, funnily enough, if you look at Sunderland's record, they've actually picked up 7 points out of 9 in the past 3 away games. They won at West Brom. They got a great draw at Leeds, and they won at, I think it was Cardiff, wasn't it? So, you know, so I'd like to see them finishing the top off. I think they deserved. I think they are one of the top 12 teams in the division. Although, yes, not this year, but overall of this season they are. Middlesbrough, well, it was a great run, wasn't it? And there was brief hopes of a playoff place, but again, I don't think too many fans really saw it. But I'd love to see Middlesbrough finish 8th. They can't really finish 7th, but I'd like to see them overhaul Coventry City, who are currently in 8th place, and finish as high in the table as possible. And isn't it a pity that we're just talking about nothing games for those two? Because, you know, there was a time in the season when we were hoping they're both in the playoffs, like they were 12 months ago. Newcastle, it was a wretched performance against Crystal Palace. They could have lost by more goals, but no one seriously expected them to lose to Sheffield United tomorrow. I was listening to the three legends. Lee Clark said 3-0. I'll go for 3-0 Newcastle, and that's a conservative prediction. But my first guest tonight, well, the first thing I've got to do is congratulate you, Dom Shaw. You are the first guest on the Black, White, Red All Over show who's notched up a hat-trick of appearances. Your prize will be in the post.
And it's a match ball I get to keep, I presume.
You'll find out what the prize is when it arrives. I understand you're down at Cardiff. Are you still on the road to Cardiff?
I am. I'm still trundling down, so apologies if the line is at all disrupted, but hopefully it's all right.
A hardy professional, Dom. No problem.
I've got someone thinks so. I hope my boss is listening.
Well, listen, the first time you were on the show, we were looking ahead to the campaign, and we were hoping that even after Borough's poor start of the season, that at least one of our teams would be in the promotion mix. And then the second time I spoke to you, well, Wembley was in the air for Middlesbrough. They were looking forward to a Carabao Cup semi-final and a potential giant killing in the FA Cup against Aston Villa. It hasn't quite worked out for either the Black Cats or Borough. Can I ask you, just before we move on to Newcastle, are you disappointed that their respective campaigns have fizzled out?
Yeah, I think, you know, this time last year, myself and Scott Wilson, my colleague, were you know, booking our Wembley hotels and seriously considering the prospect of a Borough-Sunderland playoff final.
That's right.
To be in the position they are 12 months down the line is obviously disappointing. I think, I don't think it's difficult to find the positives in Borough's season.
I agree.
To fail to win any of the first seven games, to have to deal with what's been really a pretty monumental injury crisis, and to get to the semi-finals of the Carabao Cup, and to still be in with a shout of the playoffs with three games to go up until the Leeds defeat, although I completely agree with you, I think there's been a general acceptance for a few weeks that it wasn't going to happen. I think Borough can bounce into the summer with plenty of positives. For Sunderland, I think it's been a desperately disappointing season. And let's be honest, a lot of it they've brought upon themselves.
I couldn't agree more. I think we were talking on your first appearance immediately after the Southampton game when they won 5-0. And I honestly thought in the days after that Sunderland could compete for second place, automatic promotion behind Leicester. Everything looked right. Yes, we knew Ross Stewart was on his way, but we did expect at least one of the four strikers who came in to produce the goods. Clark was thriving. You know, Bellingham had made a good start. Neil looked class. Ballard. Everything looked good. And yes, there was a blip before in November, which led to Tony Mowbray's axing in early December. But again, I don't know one Sunderland fan who thinks that was a good move by the board.
No, and it's not just a case of Sunderland fans being wise after the event. That was the general consensus at the
Correct.
Time as well, wasn't it?
It was. It was.
And I think it was that Southampton game where we were sat alongside each other in the press box, and the players you've mentioned there, we were saying how many potential Premier League players are in this Sunderland team. Patterson,
I remember the conversation.
Patterson, Ballard, Hume, Neil, Bellingham, Clark. You could go on and on. Now, clearly, Mowbray's sacking didn't work. Michael Beale's appointment was a disaster. Then there was everything off the pitch with the Black Cats bar. I feel sorry for Mike Dodds. I don't think he's helped himself at times, but I feel sorry for Mike Dodds in that he's been dealt a difficult hand, hasn't he? And he's had some great results, Leeds and West Brom, home and away. But then equally, he's had some rotten results. I mean, that Blackburn hammering was as grim as it's been for a good few years. And I wasn't at the stage of my life last Saturday. I was at Borough on Monday, but Scott Wilson was there and said that was grim, that home defeat to Millwall. The season can't end soon enough for Sunderland. It's felt that way for a number of months rather than weeks, and it's a huge summer for them, isn't it?
It's an absolutely huge summer. I mean, what they still have is a lot of talented youngsters, whether they keep them or whether they sell one or two. Jack Clark, we all expect, will go. But, you know, Sunderland are still sitting on a gold mine, albeit a gold mine which isn't quite as valuable as we thought it was 6 months ago. But those kids are still there, and they're improving. Now, today, I noticed Sunderland have been linked with Joe Willock's brother, Chris, who is available, right. I think, on a Bosman from QPR. Now, he's a... I wouldn't call him a goal-scoring midfield. He scored four goals, but he's 26 years old, and he might have that championship nous and, you know, that wherewithal that Sunderland have been lacking. But enough of defenders, midfielders. What Sunderland need to find is a goal scorer for next season. You know, a Ross Stewart-type figure, an Ellis Sims. Just imagine if Sunderland had bought Ellis Sims 16 months ago. I think they'd have been right up there now, because he's flying after a difficult start at Coventry. That's their priority. And I don't necessarily think the future's bleak. I think it's good, but they need to make the right managerial appointment and, of course, the right recruitment. They can't just throw balls in the air and hope they all land on double six, because, you know, the four strikers who came in, Well, I don't expect any of them to make the market on Weir's side in the seasons to come.
No, Mason Burstow's been a huge disappointment. When they signed Absolutely. Burstow, I thought that has the look of being a good signing.
Yeah.
I mean, he featured. Only cameos, late cameos from the bench. I was gonna say, you know, if you're coming off the bench for Chelsea, you must have something about you. But to be fair, these days, I don't know whether that's the case anymore. But still, Burstow, I looked at and thought it was a good signing. Mayenda, Hamia, and Rusing. You all look at and think they might have something. 2 or 3 years down the line, we might be talking about top end championship strikers. But what they needed was not to come in with the expectation of being Sunderland's number nine who were going to fill the boots left by Ross Stewart. What they needed was an experienced number nine, a goal scorer to work off, really. Get a few games here and there, go out on loan like Mayenda has in the second half of the season. The problem for those players has been, because no one else has come in, that they were suddenly dealt the expectation of you're going to be the ones who fill the void that Sunderland have needed to fill for three windows now. They can't take another punt with a striker, can they? They need to sign a striker. And there's 24 clubs in the Championship that want to do this. It doesn't come cheap. They need to sign a striker that guarantees them goals next season.
I agree. And I have got some sympathy with Chris Speakman and the model. What Sunderland must avoid, and which they did in the past, which can lead to financial disaster, is sign a striker on the way down. What they need to sign is a striker on the way up, but somebody who is a little bit more experienced than the ones that did last year. Ask me who that person is. I don't know. There's one or two. Maybe they'll be looking at Scotland again, because obviously that's where Ross Stewart came from. Ellis Sims, was part of the squad at Everton who wasn't getting a game. I think that's the type of player that they've got to look for. What they don't need is somebody who's 29, 30, 31, who's played a handful of games in the Premier League this season.
No, and I think two things. There was one interesting admission from Speakman earlier this season, and I think it might have been when he was speaking to the press around maybe after Beale had gone and he was speaking with Dodds. And he said, maybe we need to be a bit clearer with sign. Maybe we need to make clearer our expectations with signing. So, for example, when Hamia or Mayenda signs, they'd benefit from probably Speakman or one of the head coach coming out and saying, we have high hopes for this player, but we've got to be patient with him. It's probably not going to be this year. I think that's a start. Secondly, I completely agree with what you were saying there. You don't want to sign someone on the way down. But I do think the squad desperately needs a sprinkling of experience. And three head coaches this year, Beale, Dodds and Mowbray, have all talked about needing that bit of grey hair. And I think that, Corey Evans' future is uncertain. He's out of contract in the summer. He could go. But again, so important behind the scenes. You need to replace that. Mowbray used to talk about it all the time, didn't he? About how for the players, it's important to hear it from one of their teammates, not from a 60-year-old bloke. And that was Mowbray saying it. You need that in the dressing room, don't you? You desperately do.
Yep. It's a very good point. I think Neil has arguably been, Dan Neil's arguably been Sunderland's player of the year. Ekwa, I think, an outstanding talent, needs to kick up the backside now and again. And I think Mowbray gave him it. I think he's very much needs to stick one day, the carrot the next.
And the frustrating thing with Ekwa is, in a game we've sat there and watched games, like when he's on song, I don't think there's many, if any, better midfield players in the Championship. But then you see him perform like that 1 week, and then the next week, as managers have said, he's so frustrating because he just lets the game pass him by. Getting consistency out of Ekwa is clearly going to be one of the main priorities for the new head coach. And as looks likely, finding a way to replace Jack Clarke. Oh, let's be honest, that's an unenviable task, isn't it, for any manager coming in?
It is. Let's turn to Borough, Dom. And now, it's interesting, Michael Carrick, in his pre-match press conference ahead of the Cardiff game, he said that in many respects, this season's been more satisfying than last. Now, on face value, that sounds a strange thing to say, considering they reached the playoffs last year. But I know what he's talking about. He's saying they have had such bad injuries that he has had to mix and match. He's had to adapt his squad. The players have had to learn to play in unfamiliar positions because there have been so many, you know, round holes and square pegs, etc. But they do look as if they've got a solid, solid platform for August. And, of course, they've got a striker whose form over the last 2 months or so has been as good as any Middlesbrough striker in recent memory.
Yeah, it's interesting because I look at Borough's squad and the areas that they're likely to address in the summer, and they need a centre-forward. You know, they've got Lartey Lath and they've got Josh Coburn. Obviously, Coburn's season's been disrupted by injury. They need a centre-forward. But whoever comes in is surely going to be playing second fiddle to Lartey Lath at the start of next season, because he has been absolutely brilliant the last few weeks. And I thought both of his goals against Leeds on Monday night
were
class. I mean, the second was so instinctively brilliant, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. I thought, even up to a few months ago, that he was an impact player who would come off the bench and could make a difference. But he's proved me wrong. He is better than that. What I would suggest, Dom, is Michael Carrick knows that Middlesbrough cannot afford a poor start at come August. Now, 2 years ago, Chris Wilder, who didn't impress during the second half of his tenure at the Riverside, but he had the carpet pulled from under him when Tavernier was sold to Bournemouth. I think it was the day before the season started. I was at his press conference that day, and you could tell that all his best laid plans were in tatters. And then, of course, last year, well, I think the moment the final whistle blew in the playoff defeat at home to Coventry, Michael Carrick knew he had a tough rebuilding task. And basically, he didn't get it done in time, not necessarily his fault. Middlesbrough made a disastrous start. I think they made a worse start, people forget, than Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
You know, they lost all their games in August. I think, you know, the Carabao Cup was something of offered some redemption. But Middlesbrough cannot afford to do that. They've got to hit the ground running when next season starts.
Yeah, I remember being at the Sheffield, you mentioned Sheffield Wednesday. I remember being at Hillsborough in September. Borough drew 1-1 there. They were 1-0 down at half-time. And the first half was as bad a Borough 45 minutes as I can remember in a long time. Second half, they came back, scrambled a point, and then the week after they beat Southampton and they had liftoff. This summer's bound to be different, because last summer, like you said, from the minute the full-time whistle went against Coventry, you knew an overhaul was about to take place. Loanees like Cameron Archer, Aaron Ramsey, Ryan Giles, Zach Steffen were all going to go back. Tuber Akpom's exit was inevitable. Doesn't feel like that this summer. Ralf Vandenberg is in demand, but has already spoke to the Dutch media and said he has no intentions of leaving. There'll be a tension around Hayden Hackney, undoubtedly. But after the season he's had, I do think Hackney would benefit from another year at Borough. I don't think they'll struggle to keep Lartey Lath as much as he's been excellent recently. I don't think he's quite done enough to tempt Premier League clubs, for example, in the coming in for him. So although there's going to be exits, Paddy McNair's contract's up, I expect him to go. There's going to be one or two others, Anthony Dykstra, you look at, I think he's going to go. I think this summer's going to be more about adding to what's there.
Yes.
And Carrick has talked a lot about building on the foundations of the squad, building on the foundations of the performances of recent season. And I think also building on the foundations of the difficulties that they've gone through this year. You know, not just the form, the injuries, Riley McGree, Marcus Forst, Josh Coburn, Dale Fry, Darren Lenihan, Tommy Smith. You could go on and on and on with Hayden Hackney, with key players who've missed a chunk of games. I was at Southampton not so long ago for Southampton's draw with Borough. And Borough had a starting 11 out of players, and it was a good starting 11. And you looked at that and thought, for Borough to be the position they're in with what they've had to put up with, yeah, clearly it's disappointing not to make the top six. But I think Borough will finish the season and think, if we're only 4, 5, 6 points off, having not won any of our first 7 games and dealt with that injury crisis, surely we're going to be in a strong position.
That's a good way, a very logical way of looking at it. And I'd like to add the fact that Lewis O'Brien, who I am a fan of, I saw a lot of him at Huddersfield. I was surprised that he didn't make more of an impact at Nottingham Forest. He's been injured this season and he's only just getting his match fitness back. I think he's going to be a major, major player next season, as I believe Will Finn is ours. I think those two could be a very, very good midfield partnership for Middlesbrough. Whether Johnny Howson carries on being a regular, we don't know, but he's confounded us before. He is the Peter Pan of football.
Yeah, he is. It's funny because I was at an event at the Riverside. It'll have been a couple of months ago now, and I said to Johnny Howson then, we've had this conversation. It feels like we've had this conversation for the last 3 or 4 seasons at this stage of the year, but where do we stand with your contract situation? And he laughed and said, well, I know I'm 36 in May, I think it is, but I have no intentions of hanging up the boots. If I don't get a contract at Borough, I'd play on elsewhere. And I, it would not surprise me if next March, April, we were having the exact same conversation.
We're having the same conversation, yeah.
If you watched the game with zero knowledge and just watched Johnny Howson and didn't judge it on his age, you'd give him a new contract, wouldn't you? Yeah, his age is telling us he should be slowing down, but his performances aren't.
I agree. One last question on Borough before we move on to Newcastle, Dom. Sam Greenwood, will they sign him on a permanent basis?
It's a difficult one because £1.5 million for a player of his age, with his talent and his potential, has the look of being a snip. So with that in mind, I still think it's a possibility, but I think he's been desperately disappointing in the second half of the season. Yeah. I think if you're judging it on his performances, then I think it's hard to make a case to sign him. The other thing that muddies the waters is if Leeds go up, he's in line for a wage increase at Leeds, and I would suspect he'd go back to Leeds, although Daniel Farke's made it pretty clear he's not part of his plans there. I'd suspect at this stage it's more unlikely than likely.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Newcastle, who've got Sheffield United at home tomorrow. They've got the home form back in order, but the performance at Crystal Palace on Wednesday night, it was back to the dark days of December and January, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that was so disappointing on the back of the Spurs win. And I do wonder whether the 11-day gap between games would you with the yep. with the injuries they've had to deal with. But I do wonder, just because they had a bit of momentum, didn't they? And they were so impressive against Spurs. Desperately disappointing to not really lay a glove on Palace. I think tomorrow's a good game for them, though, to bounce back from that. Like you said at the top, I fully expect them to swat aside Sheffield United with ease, really.
Which is something which Manchester United didn't do the other night, did they? They were 0-1 down, 1-2 down, before eventually winning 4-2. Yeah, I would expect the same. Could you get excited about a European conference place?
Not in the early stages of the competition. But I think if you look at Aston Villa now and the excitement yes. around their campaign, and I know it's helped clearly by where they are in the league, but if they win a European, look at West Ham last year and the impact that had on and how it lifted the gloom surrounding everything that was that was around David Moyes. I think the early stages of the Europa Conference League campaign had been hard going, wouldn't they? Playing against teams who, let's be honest, did swat aside in the group. We'd go to games knowing very little about the teams and the players who play for them and what they're going to bring. It's hardly the glory nights of PSG and Milan and Dortmund that we saw at the start of this season. But I still think, let's look at where Newcastle were like 5 years ago. And any European competition shouldn't be sniffed at. I think the Europa League campaign would be exciting. I completely get where you're coming from, the Europa Conference League, but I still think they'd be better in it than out of it.
Yes, I agree. And as one mate of mine said, the home games early on might be boring, but there'll be some great away trips to places they've never even heard of, which would be wonderful experiences. You know, trips to maybe Iceland, to Turkey,
And sorry to put in, I think the other thing is maybe one of the elements that has caught Newcastle out this year is dealing with the schedule of playing with European football again and the impact that has. Just another season of that experience, even if it isn't the competition you'd ideally want to be playing in. I think that can only benefit them as a club and as players and as a squad and as a coaching team in the long run.
Yeah, I think there will be a long, hard look at themselves on the injury situation. But as far as the cup draws go, well, the Champions League draw, I wouldn't call that a bad draw. I would call that a dream draw, even though it was the group of hell, but it was also the group of heaven. But surely they will get one or two easier draws in the various competitions next year. But I honestly don't. I think it will be disappointing if Newcastle miss out on Europe completely, which I don't think will happen. Quite honestly, I don't think it matters in many respects, whether it's a conference or the Europa League, because they are still European novices. It's still a club which is progressing nicely with a lot of money behind it. So really, you know, I think if Newcastle finish sixth or seventh, which I suspect they will do, then that will go down as a good 7 out of 10 campaign.
Yeah, and I think it'd probably be about par for where they'd have expected to be a couple of years ago. The problem is they exceeded expectations so dramatically last season, didn't they? That obviously brought everything forward. But I agree. I think considering the everything that surrounds the first season back in the Champions League, the challenge of building on last year, the injuries they've had to deal with, I agree. I think it'd be about par if they were going to finish sixth or seventh. What's interesting is you look at the semi-finals with PSG and Dortmund both in there at the Champions League, and although Newcastle finished bottom, the margins were so fine in that group, weren't they?
The late
controversy at PSG, the chances missed at home at Dortmund. There were various what-if moments in that campaign. And I think Eddie Howe admitted this week, that it's hard not to look and think what-if when you look back at that campaign and what could be.
I agree. Well, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask you your predictions on the three games. I suspect I know what they are, but Newcastle v Sheffield United.
I would have gone 3-0, but seeing as though I think yourself and Lee Clark both went 3, I'll go 4. I think it'll
you'll
be
go 4.
Newcastle.
And Cardiff City v Middlesbrough.
I think Borough will actually find a way to keep the momentum ticking over, even though they lost on Monday because of the manner of the defeat. I fancy them tomorrow. I think they'll win 2-1.
I'm going 1-1, and Watford Sunderland.
Sunderland are the great unknown at the minute, aren't they? They are better away from home, but Watford, although they haven't been getting results of late, I think they'll be lifted by the clarity of Tom Cleverley's appointment this week, having a 1-1 draw.
I'm going, sadly, a 2-0 win for the Hornets because of the Cleverley factor. You know, I think it's always dangerous playing a side with a new manager in charge. Listen, thank you very much. And how many miles you got to go before you reach your hotel?
2.5, so we've timed it to perfection.
Nice one. You take care. Enjoy a nice bottle of wine tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care. Enjoy your weekend.
All the best, Tom. Take care.
Great stuff.
My goodness, has done a few miles. The Northern Echo boys this season, covering all three sides on the road, and that's just about the longest trip, isn't it? The Southampton, Swansea, and one, of course, there'll be Portsmouth next season as well. Yeah,
Plymouth, I think, is the longest, but outside
Plymouth,
of course. Yeah, you know, when you're doing Swansea, Cardiff, all that sort of area, across country as well as down, many miles.
Yes, I remember those days. It was great.
So do I.
Getting back to the hotel. And I remember a veteran radio broadcaster, just to go a bit left field for a moment. We were staying in the Holiday Inn in Portsmouth for a game at Fratton Park, and after the match, you rush to Fratton Station, then you get a train to Waterloo. You go across the tubes, and you make the 8:30 at King's Cross, heading back to the northeast. And this person, who shall not be named, suddenly said, right, I'll just ring my wife to arrange for her to pick me up at 11:30 at the Newcastle Central Station. Now, this was the early 90s, at the time when mobile phones were like bricks. He got it out. He couldn't understand why it wasn't working until we pointed out to him he'd picked up his TV remote control from his hotel, and the brick mobile phone was still in room 408 at the Holiday Inn in Fratton.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think I know it is, actually, but we'll not mention any names. I remember talking long journeys, a very quick one. I remember going down, we were doing commentary with Malcolm Allison on a Borough game. It was Borough down at Home Park, Plymouth Argyle, Tuesday night game. I think it was a cup match, was it? A cup replay? I can't remember. But we got all the way down, got off the train, only to see an airboard with chalk written on this airboard on the platform. Tonight's game off waterlogged pitch. And we were on the last train that left Plymouth to get back up north again. But thankfully they rearranged it for 24 hours later, so we hung around and we got the game the next day.
Fair enough. Mm. Well, is our next guest ready yet?
We need to take a quick break and then we'll have a chat with him.
Black and white and red all over. 3 decades of reporting northeast football. Ian Murta. The cat, the tune
and the red. If there was an award for covering the most amount of football matches this season, then I think my next guest would win it hands down. In fact, he probably won it last year, and I'm sure he's the favourite to win it next year as well. He is the doyen of non-league football writers. It's Mark Carruthers, and welcome to the Black, White and Red All Over show for the first time, Mark. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks for that that illustrious opening. It's very kind of you.
Tell me how many matches. I'm sure you're the type of person who does keep count.
I do, yeah. I'm on to 94, it'll be tomorrow.
Wow.
So it's been a busy season, punctured by a lot of off-field issues too.
And how's your wife with having been out 94 times to matches?
Surprisingly happy, and I'm not sure what to make of that.
Now, listen, I'm sure, I mean, you're busy, you'll be covering the Hebbins-Stockton playoff and Gateshead in the FA Trophy at Wembley in a couple of weeks' time, but I'm sure, knowing you, you'd rather be even more busy, because, let's face it, it's been a controversial, a disappointing end for the North East. We've had Blythe's self-inflicted relegation. We've had Spennymoor and South Shields just missing out on promotion, or on the playoffs for promotion to the National League. And of course, let's start with Gateshead. And I'm sure you've written thousands of words about it and spoken thousands of words. But briefly, you know, is it a massive injustice, and whose fault is it?
Yeah, I've certainly written plenty of words and spoken them, and continue to do both as well, because I don't think this issue is going to go away anytime soon. I mean, obviously, I've been to a lot of Gator games this season, and firstly, I'll say on the pitch, they've been one of the stories of the Northeast football game this season. I mean, we both know the budget there is not massive. Far from it. Quite the opposite, to be fair. And to be where they are in the league is, I always say, it's the equivalent of Nottingham Forest being in the Champions League this season. So it's remarkable what they've achieved on the pitch. But off the pitch, yeah, I mean, to finish in the playoffs, to have a chance of bringing, you know, Football League football back to Gateshead for the first time since 1960, and to have that taken away from you by red tape and bureaucracy, it's awful. And it's heartbreaking for the players, it's heartbreaking for the management, the club, the volunteers, for everyone involved. Yes, to try and narrow it down to a blame game is probably tough. It's probably a bigger picture looking at, you know, government cutbacks on local councils and their funding. That's sort of triggered the situation with Gateshead Council looking to bring in new parties to run their leisure facilities. Obviously, the international stadium is part of that. And that's really brought what it's down to, because the council have got a tender process going on at the moment. They can't offer Gateshead the 10-year security of tenure that they need to get into the Football League or even compete to get in there. So at the moment, we're kind of...
I think we've lost you, Mark. Are you there?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Good. Yes, you just briefly faded. Yes, I can hear you loud and clear now, Mark.
Yep. So the council can't give Gateshead the 10-year security tender the need to get into the... Sorry, 10-year. The need to get into the Football League or even compete to get in there. So it's really... That's where we're stuck. There's legal issues going on at the moment, legal wranglings. So we'll see what happens.
I mean... It's a brutal question in many respects. What's the point of Gateshead playing football next season?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I think I've thought of myself, because they can't go up. I think they've got too good a squad to go down. So they're kind of just stuck playing for, you know, to play the National League and playing games to try and progress in the FA Trophy, the FA Cup. So it's a very pertinent question, to be fair. I guess we'll find out once this tender process that the council undertaken is finished, what the future holds for the stadium, and as a consequence, what it holds for Gateshead Football Club.
You must have expected at least one of Spennymoor and South Shields to be in the playoffs, and I think they were just edged out on the last day, weren't they? But both those clubs seem in pretty healthy states and upwardly mobile.
Yeah, very much so. Spenny's journey up the non-league pyramid's been a good one. I mean, it's only 3-4 years since they almost got into the National League and joined Gateshead in there, beaten on a penalty shootout in the playoff final against Chorley. They've got a lot of long-serving players there that have had great careers. James Curtis, a Northeast non-league legend, has just announced his retirement.
What is he, 68 now, is he?
he's not far short, but I mean, what a career he's had. It takes a lot to be a legend at two different clubs, which he's done at Gateshead and Spennymoor. They've got Glenn Taylor, who for me is one of the best strikers never to have played in the Football League. So it was a shame to see them miss out, because I think if they got in the playoffs, there would have been a real threat for everyone. South Shields have had a weird season. I mean, started off with the appointment of Julio Arca, a novice in terms of management, really. Didn't quite work out. Elliot Dickman came in, former Newcastle and Sunderland Academy coach, and he sort of steadied the ship a bit. And they only missed out on the last day of the season, which was remarkable, really. To still be in the fight that late on. So it's a shame to say they missed out. But, I mean, Elliot has been now confirmed as permanent manager, so it's exciting to see what the future brings under him.
And incredible crowds there, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. And I think there is a little bit of a perfect storm that happened at South Shields, where their sort of renaissance came alongside Newcastle and Sunderland's fall from grace, if you can call it that. We'll go with that. They've sort of gained a lot of supporters that have become disenfranchised from the top two in the region, with all due respect to Middlesbrough, by the way. At the time, they were definitely the top two. But that support has been retained, which is credit to South Shields as a football club. It's credit to the support as well. And you look at it now, I mean, regularly getting over 2,000 is phenomenal. I think if they were to get in the National League, you would see that go up even higher. And hopefully one day, although there is a sale process ongoing with the club, hopefully one day they will get in the Football League.
Let's hope so. And is it possible for you to talk about Blythe Spartans' demise without resorting to bad language? Because we talk about Sunderland's slide down the table being self-inflicted, but you look at Blythe Spartan, my goodness, you know, they were looking good for the playoffs themselves back in back in autumn. I remember, you know, seeing you at in August at that game against Spennymoor when we were both waxing lyrical about the performance.
Well, they were as good as I've seen a Blythe team for a lot of years in that game against a very good Spennymoor side. I think the thing that probably annoyed me more, and I know it have annoyed John Shaw as well, the manager, is just the amount of late goals they've conceded. You know, goals in the last 5 minutes of games, goals in injury time.
Yeah,
they would have been comfortably safe, and I would argue, without knowing the maths behind it, I would argue would be looking at top half of the table, because it just at one point felt like every week Blythe have conceded 88th minute, Blythe have conceded 91st. The other week they conceded 97th minute. I think it was Warrington Rylands. So
surely that's the management team's fault. Is it a fitness issue, Mark?
No, I think I think it was more of a concentration issue on the pitch. To be honest, mm-hmm. What I would say is they have had a really bad sort of list of injuries this season, as a lot of clubs have. I think it's been a common theme, but I think it just goes down to that concentration, really, and being unable to maybe select a regular defensive lineup. That's been a struggle for them as well. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there's no one to blame other than themselves for going down. There's obviously the takeover was a bit of an unnecessary distraction, I guess you would say. And there's obviously a lot of questions around that, and you know, the intentions of the new owners. Released a statement earlier in the week, and I said it at the time. I said it when the takeover was announced, and I say it now. It's not words that are needed. It's actions.
It's actions. Yes.
It's down to the new owners to do that. So we look forward to seeing what the summer brings, and they're going into what will be another exciting league for North East Non-League football, because you've got Morpeth in there. We will have one of Hebden and Stockton. And whoever doesn't win that league could end up being in the playoffs with Dunstan. So it's that Northern Premier League, Premier Division is going to be an interesting league to cover next season.
Isn't it just now, never mind non-league manager of the year. If there was a North East manager of the year, Steve Watson must be a contender. Darlington, they looked absolutely dead and buried before he came in, didn't they? And they secured National League North safety with one game to go?
With a week to go, yeah. I mean, I'll throw something else in here that, and I think Steve wouldn't mind us saying this, that Terry Mitchell was just as big a part of that as he's assistant manager, very much a management team. The old good cop, bad cop in there as well, I think. But you look at what they've done. I mean, when they took over, they were absolutely, as you say, dead and buried in terms of the National League North. I think there wasn't anyone in the country thought that they would stay up, and to do it with room to spare. There's been a number of turning points, a number of big wins. I mean, they absolutely hammered Scunthorpe, who've put a lot of money in this season to try and get back in the National League. That felt like the launch pad for what's gone on. I saw them beat Blythe up at Blythe pretty comfortably in the end. The signing of Matty Young, Sunderland goalkeeper, has been a real catalyst for more defensive solidity in there. So they've just, Steve Watson, a phenomenal job, and I'm really, really excited to see what he does in the summer. Putting his own stamp on the squad, there's already been departures. So it's a really exciting time for Darlington fans, and yeah, I think they could be one to watch next season.
And there's a young striker, Rutledge, who they got from Gateshead.
Yeah, I mean, he was on loan, Aidan Rutledge. The story behind
I'll tell you why I mentioned him. I was at school with his dad, Brian, who was an outstanding footballer who ended up going to Oxford University, getting an Oxford Blue. He was a superb footballer. Sadly, he got stuck down with multiple sclerosis and died two or three years ago. So I've been keeping a watchful eye on his son, and I'm delighted to see he's scoring goals like his father did.
And the interesting thing with Aidan is he really broke through at Burnley Town in the second division of the Northern League, where scored 60 over 60 goals in a season to get them promoted, and then got to move to Gateshead. So he did all right at Gateshead in the first few weeks of the season. Just needed regular game time to continue his development. So he's went out on loan, went to Scarborough Athletic, and then to Darlington. And there's an interesting, probably an interesting few months ahead for him to see what the next move is, whether he stays at Gateshead and tries to re-establish himself there, or maybe goes out on loan again. So he is one to watch, though, because he's definitely got something.
Mm. Now, as the expert of non-league football, I'm going to give you a quiz question, Mark.
Uh-oh.
70 years ago this weekend, what famous Northeast football event took place?
I'm going to guess, would it be an amateur cup final?
You would guess correctly. In fact, I think you're being too modest there. I think you knew. It's not a guess. That's right. It was Crooktown 2, Bishop Auckland 2, in front of 100,000 at Wembley. A few days later, they came up to St. James's Park, a 56,000 sellout, and it was at 0-0. A second replay, Ayresome Park, 46,000 sellout, and Crooktown 1. It still, incredibly, holds the record for the aggregate attendance for any cup final in this country. My special interest was my mother's family were from Crook. And at the time, my auntie was teaching in Bishop Auckland, my mum in Cowden. And it's just, and it apparently, it just the whole area just left to go to Wembley. And it's so incredible. Those figures, they sound almost fairy tale, make believe. Now, years ago, when I was cutting my teeth in journalism at the Northern Echo, I can remember writing a piece which had a very controversial headline. It was "Hotbed of Soccer, You've Got to Be Kidding." And it was talking about how the demise of the crowds at places like Bishop Auckland, who were struggling to pull in 500, Darlington, who were fighting re-election in the fourth tier. Great days in hindsight, fourth year. They were averaging 1,300, 1,400. Hartlepool weren't much better. Is this a hotbed of soccer for non-league football, Mark?
I think we've seen possibly over the last 10 years something of a rejuvenation. Sadly, we have seen clubs going out of business, but I think that's maybe symptomatic of the wider financial issues that we're facing as a society without getting too deep into things. I think we are seeing attendances on the whole going up. I mean, I was at Heaton Stannington last night, and you know they've had unbelievable crowds. They've had 10 games this season where they've got over 400, and that's a club that were in the Northern Alliance not so long ago. Newcastle Blue Star.
I think Craig Cope takes his young lads there.
Craig been to a few non-league games. I know he's got an interest in Blue Star as well. I mean, I'm a Leamington lad originally, and you know the West End of Newcastle has never really had a Northern League club for a lot of decades now. I think we're looking back in the 50s, 40s. To see Blue Star back and in the Division Two playoffs next weekend, they've got Friday night a semi-final against Horden, another famous Pitt Village as well, of course. Yep. I think we are seeing something of maybe a renaissance might be overplaying it, but certainly an improvement in what's going on in the non-league scene. And I think part of that, I will say, is down to volunteers across the board. The way clubs are promoting themselves has been excellent. The use of social media and things like that has been, there's a lot of forward thinking things going on. So I think we are getting there, but I agree it did have a little bit of a lull despite the Vols' dominance. But I think we are starting to see some improvement in that sense.
And is that because youngsters are deciding to support the non-league team, or is it because people are maybe disaffected with the professional game? Now, I remember, you know, as you correctly stated, you know, Sunderland, when they relegated to third tier, a lot of Sunderland fans switched to South Shields. A lot of Newcastle fans gave up during the Mike Ashley era and went to Whitley Bay or Heaton Stannington maybe. And there are a few fans I know who disapprove of the Saudi regime, and they've switched to non-league football, and they're loving it. I mean, I do try and get to games. I've been to Spennymoor, Blyth Spartans a few times in recent years, and I love them. They're great setups. Gates said, they play wonderful football. I must admit, I don't like watching football at the international arena. And I remember when Graham Wood was chairman there, he was talking about a new stadium. I'd love to see Gateshead in their own stadium of maybe a 5,000 capacity. And I think that's what they're probably missing to pull in more locals. But so what do you think attracts people to non-league football? Is it disillusion with professional game, or is it something else?
I think there probably is a little bit of that. And I'll be honest, I mean, over the last week, I've been at games at Wickham, Newcastle, Benfield, and as I said last night, at Heaton Stannington. And the one thing that struck me was all three clubs had a young core of supporters that were, and you may not approve of this, but playing drums, banging on anything they could to make noise, singing songs of, you know, for the players and stuff. And it was really heartening to see, because I think traditionally, with all due respect to non-league football, it has been seen as maybe, for the older man even. I include myself as one of those now. So,
No, you're not.
I feel it after this season. I feel it. But I think it has been a case of that. There is a younger generation coming through where non-league football has been as attractive. And that's been really heartening. It really has. I do think part of it, and again, this is probably going into a wider conversation, is down to the cost of supporting a club at the top end of the game. But also, I think the fact that a lot of non-league clubs now, it's not the traditional or the stereotypical view of it, that they play long ball, the big man, little man up front, not got long and all that. A lot of them are trying to play good, attractive football, and maybe this is going into the old, Pep Guardiola's influence on English football, trying to play out from the back and do all those sort of things, wing-backs pushing forward, inverted full-backs and all that sort of stuff. So it is more attractive to watch on the pitch as well.
I mean, I remember when I was cutting my teeth in journalism, some of the finest writing was non-league football. There was Simon Turnbull, who became a nationally renowned athletics writer, but he loved covering the non-league beat. And then, of course, you'll remember Paul Tully, who was as good a writer of prose as anyone you'll ever read. He did some wonderful stories, and he was a huge Newcastle fan. He was a member of the 92 club, but he went to Carlisle, he went to Sunderland when Newcastle weren't playing. He got as much of a kick out of going to any non-league ground as he did going to in front of, full houses at St. James's Park. And I've got some, I remember those games when you were very helpful when you were working at Blyth Spartans, when we played Sam Allardyce's Blackburn in front of the Satanta cameras. And then, of course, there was the great game against Birmingham when they were 2-0 up and only to lose 3-2. Robbie Dale proved, as one journalist wrote in the Daily Telegraph 2 days before, Robbie Dale is arguably the greatest non-league player in the country. And it was a bit of a sweeping statement, but my goodness, that those 45 minutes, he certainly looked like it.
He did, yeah. I mean, I also remember the Hartlepool United game when certain journalist...
God, that was cold.
Who may be on the other end of this call said that he'd never seen such bad behaviour in a press box when Jarrett River scored. But we'll not go any further than that.
Did you misbehave yourself and cheer in a press box? Did you, Carruthers?
I was working for the club at the time, to be fair. But they were great days, and I look at that cup run, and obviously, and I appreciate why. But as national journalists, you saw the two games you mentioned there, but the run from the very start of it was just phenomenal. I mean, got battered down at Darlington in the first qualifying round, should have went out quite comfortably, and somehow got a draw, and then won the replay 3-0, got a last minute winner. Beat Skelmersdale, who were top of Bly's league at the time, 4-1 away. Yeah. Got a last minute winner at Michelover Sports, and then played one of the most epic games of football I've ever seen in the fourth qualifying round against Leek Town, where it was 4-3 and Blyth, again, 2-0 down at half-time, came back and won. And then in the first round got Altrincham, who at the time were two levels higher than Blyth, and beat them 4-1.
I remember.
At Croft Park.
Before you go, we're running out of time. I do need the three predictions. I want you to give me score lines for Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough tomorrow. But I'm going to ask you, being you, a fourth prediction. Who will be the next Football League club in the North East? So we'll have the score lines for, first of all, Newcastle v Sheffield United.
I'll say Newcastle will win 3-1.
3-1. Watford v Sunderland.
That is at Watford, isn't it? I'll go for a 1-1 draw.
And Cardiff v Middlesbrough.
I'll go 2-1 Borough.
And finally, a one-word answer. Who will be the next non-league club in the Football League?
That was really tough. I'm going to go... Actually, you know what? I'll go the safe option and say I'll go with Gateshead. And this will get resolved and everyone will be happy.
Excellent. Pleasure to have you on. And we'll have you back next year very soon. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Together, across the North East, three brand new radio stations by the fans, for the fans, on DAB Radio, online, and smart speakers. Right across the North East, the Red, the Toon, and the